Okay, we're talking with Dr. Howard Brody, who is presently professor in the Department of Family Practice and former director of the Center for Ethics and the Humanities.
That's right.
Okay.
Correct.
Did you do your undergraduate work here?
Yes.
Okay. And what was your major?
My major was biochemistry, and then as I moved into the last years of my work, I became very interested in philosophy, so I set out to do a minor in philosophy, but I never quite finished enough credits to officially have a philosophy minor.
Okay. And you started in medical school what year?
1971.
Okay. In the spring of 1971, just before you started medical school, you came around to the department and seeing if we had any jobs.
Yes.
And we gave you a job.
Yes.
What were you doing?
Okay. What I was doing was, first of all, that year I was working, the 70-71 year, I was working in Jim Trosko's lab. Okay. Because I had sought out, as part of my work with the Honors College, I had been expected to do something in biochemistry and do some sort of laboratory research experience as a senior year project. And somebody had the very good sense to suggest that given that I was developing this interest in philosophy, that the person I might like to work with was not somebody actually in biochemistry, but that I might actually find something to do in Jim Trosko's lab. So he very kindly let me into his lab. He insists I broke everything and destroyed all the equipment, but that isn't, I'll dispute that particular rendition of events. And as part of that, I got interested in the work he was doing, because at that time in what was then the Justin Morrill College, the old residential liberal arts college, he had a course that he was teaching, which I believe was called Science and Human Values. So I also sat in on that course and found it quite intriguing. So in many ways, Jim was kind of opening the door into my later career in medical ethics and medical humanities, because he was sort of showing me what was at that time being done in that field. And then what I did when I applied to medical school and was considering coming to Michigan State, I had a talk with the dean of students. And I basically said at that time I was an out-of-state resident. I was a resident of Illinois. And I asked, what do you do financially for out-of-state students? And he said, we tell them to get in-state residency. And the way you do that at that time was very easy. You could drop out of school for 6 months, get a job, and then you're a Michigan resident.
Right.
So I said, oh, okay. So rather, I had intended to finish up my work in Jim's lab that spring, but that was when we had the quarter system, so I just had one more quarter to go of the year. But I said, okay, I need my residency, so I have to drop out this semester and next semester, the summer, and then start up in medical school in the fall. So at that point, I sought the question of how could I get a job here. And I think I saw you and wandered by your office, and since I was at that time sort of already hanging out in human development, I just had some sense of who was around, and so I came asking, is there a job?
Okay, and what did you do on that job?
Well, the job turned out to be with Terry Hattie and with Doris Nairns and with you, and it was an iron deficiency anemia project, and I can't remember much about what the actual, at that time, the sort of big picture was. All I knew is that we were following a number of children with iron deficiency anemia and doing some blood work on them. And I was, in effect, kind of like hanging out with Terry Hattie and sort of being a very junior apprentice. And, I don't know that I did anything of any use, but she taught me an awful lot about pediatric hematology in that first 6 months. So it was almost like an entry into medical school all by itself, because we actually did home visits and saw patients and collected some blood samples. And then Doris was working on the dietary recall and trying to figure out what these kids were eating and how that related to the iron deficiency. And you were doing the sociological part of that. So I got to meet these people who were doing all this interesting stuff and got sort of a entry level view of a multidisciplinary research project. And then, of course, in the process, got to know some of the other faculty and Art Corman and Dave Kaufman and some others who were in the department.
Okay.
Just from hanging around.
What I remember was we had a grant for the Air Deficiency Anemia Project, but that wasn't the one we paid you off of.
I always had the impression that you had your hand in, you know, several different bags of money and mm-hmm. you moved your fans around fast enough so nobody could see which hand had what money in it at what time. So
yeah.
So I think you moved some money around and got me paid out of one fund and paid the grant back in some other fund or something. But I had no clue as to what was going on then.
Yeah, we were able to pay you on a salary line where you did not have to be a graduate assistant.
Yes, because I had to be out of school. It was important that I not be officially affiliated with the university during that time, that I was in theory becoming a resident of Michigan by not being a student.
Yep.
So, yes, that was what happened. Which if somebody goes back and looks at that now, maybe I owe Michigan State for, you know, a bunch of years of out-of-state tuition. Because I believe they later considerably tightened up those requirements, and what I did then is no longer possible.
I think it is. But you have to come to the state. When I was a graduate student, if you came to the state to go to school, it was almost impossible to establish in-state tuition. Mm-hmm. And all you could do was not only drop out of school, but apply to be readmitted. Because mm-hmm. I had to do that. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then you hung out with the department for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And what else did you do?
Well, over a period of time, I ended up getting various graduate assistantships sent my way. And I don't recall what I might have done in the I think I do. I believe it was as part of that first year that I can't remember if this was actually a paid project or not, but I was doing something that had to do with the embryology course that was being taught in the medical school and trying to tie together the stages of embryogenesis with certain congenital defects that show up in the newborn and trying to develop some kind of a graphic or table that would help medical students learn that. I can't remember if that was a paid thing or something I just got interested in. But then what particularly happened that was very important was that that Jim Trosko had introduced me to the Hastings Center, which was just getting established in New York and was becoming a kind of national think tank around the new interest in bioethics. And they announced in the summer of 1972 that they were going to hold the first national conference on teaching medical ethics.
Mm.
And Jim wanted to go to that, but something came up that he couldn't go. And he then asked me if I would be willing to go. And, of course, I jumped at the chance, and the department paid my way to go to this conference. So I had a chance to come to the first conference in the U.S., basically, on medical ethics teaching. And essentially everybody at that time who was involved in medical ethics across the U.S. was at that conference. Mm. So it was an incredibly wonderful experience for a medical student to kind of get into a field at the get-go. And meet all the people who were people. And because so little was being done, the fact that you were a medical student didn't necessarily count against you. You could sort of get into the group very quickly. So I came back from that conference with two goals. One was I now thought I knew what it would take to put together a course that could be taught at CHM in medical ethics from what I'd picked up and the materials I saw at that conference. And then the second thing was that I decided I really wanted to do this. And if I wanted to do this, I needed to get a PhD in philosophy.
Right.
And so I came back and basically started working with Bill Weil, I think more at that time, and somewhat with Jim and Art Corman. And basically we decided Bill, I think, came through then with the graduate assistantship to let me try to put together this teaching material to have a teaching manual. Actually, we thought of it doing it as a form of a program text on medical ethics. And so Bill started supporting me in that. And then Bill also and Jim became my sort of champions going over to the Department of Philosophy to see whether we could work out a joint MD-PhD program, which was set up by the end of that year. So starting in the summer of 1973, I was able to go back and forth between my clerkships in the medical school and then the graduate's work in philosophy. So I was able to do that because of the sponsorship and support. And it ended up that Jim and Bill were on my PhD committee and along with a couple people from philosophy.
Who did you work with in philosophy?
Well, the two people on the committee were, I'm trying to remember if it was, I think it was Martin Benjamin who worked with it, and then Johanna was the person who was in philosophy of science. Okay.
And then at some point, you were doing some work with Sister Betty Geis, a child with bowel problems who had to be fed intravenously.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us about that?
Yeah. As best, I'm trying to remember where that was happening and in what stage. It was somewhere in, as I was in my more senior years of medical school and was making some progress in my PhD program, and Sister Betty had come on as a person in hired by Human Development to do more work in medical ethics. And so she and I worked together on a number of things, but what came up was that a case, somehow Don Kaufman's name pops up in connection with this case, but the baby, there was a baby named Heather who was over at Ingham Medical Hospital at that time, and she had a very difficult situation because she had short bowel syndrome and was receiving intravenous nutrition. And basically she was in a situation where they could do nothing at that time. That was before there were any bowel transplants. She had had problems that required a lot of bowel to be cut out, and she basically had too little bowel to survive. And the only way she could thrive was with intravenous nutrition. But the intravenous nutrition was fated to have to be discontinued at some point, simply because of how hard it was going to be to keep on putting in intravenous lines, and the possibility that even if she went long enough with that, the liver damage was going to be so severe because of the side effects of the nutrition that that she was essentially going to die. So we had a baby who looked like a growing, thriving baby, but in effect was living under a death sentence. And so the parents were very open and very accommodating to have people talk with them about, you know, this experience. And at that time, I think they were very hopeful that somehow or other she would pull through, that her existing bit of bowel would somehow grow and expand itself so that, contrary to expectation, she'd be able to absorb enough food orally that eventually she'd be able to come off the nutrition, which even though it was medically almost for certain that wouldn't happen, the parents were, as I recall, at the very beginning, being quite hopeful.
Yep.
And the residents were really very anguished about this case and, you know, had problems with, you know, how difficult it was emotionally to work with this family and work with the baby, although they were very, very sympathetic. And the nursing staff, of course, was extremely attached to the baby. And and so we were able to do video interviews with people at one point in time when the baby was getting the aggressive care and there was a, you know, still the hope. And then later on when the hope disappeared, later on when there was a significant, you know, they again had simply tried to get more lines in and they just absolutely could not get the line in, the baby. And, you know, then had a final interview with the parents in the last week of the baby's life when the baby was clearly dying and the parents were dealing with what that was like. I think the child ended up dying on Christmas Eve or something like that. And then later we talked to some of the doctors who were involved and you know, what it was like looking back on this case. Yeah. So it was an exploration, not so much of, you know, we called it an ethical thing, but it was really much more of a psychosocial exploration of the emotions of dealing with this. So we had a bunch of hours of videotape and we put together a couple of teaching tapes from this, and I honestly don't know that they were all ever used much, but it was a lot of pretty rich material that we had with these interviews.
Was anything ever published on this?
No, I don't think we ever published anything. So we have the video, the video, but we didn't have anything published from it. Again, it really wasn't much of a real quote-unquote dilemma, so it wasn't the sort of thing you would necessarily get a lot of attention in the ethics press, if you will, but it was
Do you know where the tapes are?
I think I still have some of those tapes. At least I think I have some of those tapes in a drawer in my office right now. So I don't. The raw tapes were done on an old machine that I'm sure doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. and they were pretty poor. By modern standards, they're extremely poor quality, but I think I saved some of the dubs that were done later. And if they're still viewable and haven't disintegrated, they're in a some of them are in a desk drawer.
Might be worthwhile having put on DVD.
If it could be done, yeah. I see what we can do.
Yeah. Okay. How come you picked Michigan State as a medical school?
I picked Michigan State as a medical school because I was here as an undergraduate.
Okay.
And I became very frustrated as a undergraduate in biochemistry with a more reductionistic way of thinking about science. And I started getting very interested as an undergraduate in philosophy because it seemed to sort of restore the big picture, and without which I felt I couldn't really flourish. And if I kept getting more and more into submolecular, atomic, numerical things, I felt I was sort of getting lost there. And it became very attractive to think about going to a medical school that had declared itself as being more about the big picture and the social implications and the human implications of medicine, at a time when most medical education in the U.S. was relentlessly reductionistic. And so I became a convert to this, here in talking with people like Trosco and others who were part of the medical school, and realizing that this was a bit of a risk and that the medical school was so new, and would I get a residency coming out of this medical school? It was a little scary. But nonetheless, the attraction of the ideas of the medical school, it just seemed such a good fit. Mm-hmm. My father had something of a conniption when I was accepted. Eventually, I was accepted to University of Illinois and to Michigan State. And when I told him I was going to Michigan State, he practically threw a fit. How could I go to this brand new upstart medical school instead of a well-established, reasonably prestigious school like University of Illinois, where in addition I was in state? That was what led me to go to the school.
Okay. Free associate a little bit about your impression of the department in the early 70s from a worm's eye view.
Okay. Of course, when I first came to the department was housed in some offices in Olin Health Center. And I actually helped when I sort of finished my bit of work that I was doing with your project was, I think I actually helped some to move to the new life science building when the department was just setting up over there. So if I had ever had any experience at a real medical school, I probably would have been aghast at how primitive everything was and how few people there were and how, everybody was doing everything and there was no university hospital, et cetera. It was interesting at that time because Olin actually was a hospital. They actually had beds over in Olin.
Yep.
And so it seemed like, well, okay, here's a medical school, here's a hospital. I guess it makes sense. But I had nothing to compare to. So I was, very fresh on this. And, what I saw were, again, a very kind of open door sort of sense, in that as a medical student, I felt like I could talk to just about any of the faculty that I ran into, and they would talk to me like I was a fellow human being and not like I was some, vermin or something. And so it just seemed like a very comfortable place to be, and the people were very comfortable people to be around. And then I don't know, it's sort of at what time it kind of sank in, or if it ever did sink in at that time, that this was special because of the different disciplines that were all represented in the department. Yep. It seemed very natural. Well, of course, you'd have a sociologist and a nutritionist and a bunch of physicians and some basic science people, and that made seem to make perfect sense.
Yeah.
So, how else would you do it? So I just sort of went with the flow. I didn't really, it just seemed like I just kind of went along with it.
Okay. So you were 2 years into medical school before you decided to go for a PhD?
No, I was one year into medical school when the formative event happened, which was attending that national conference.
Okay.
And the second year of medical school was the planning for the beginning of the PhD. So I actually occupied myself during much of that year with the meetings and the organization that was required to put the program together. And to the best of my knowledge, if I'd been at just about any other medical school and I said, I want to finish my MD, but I also want to do a PhD in philosophy, the answer probably would have been, well, you can't do that. That there's just no way. We don't have any such program. And it's a philosophy. What are you talking about? We could give you a PhD in pharmacology or physiology, but no way you could do. And Michigan State, the answer was, oh, well, gee, we've never done that before. That sounds interesting.
Yep.
And, of course, we had the benefit of the fact that the medical school was right here on the campus, so the philosophy department was a mile and a half away rather than 60 miles away or 80 miles away, as might be of some other medical schools. So, as would have been the case at that time at Illinois. So, again, I had a sort of the feeling of good fortune that I was in the right place at the right time for doing what I wanted to do.
And the philosophy department was also receptive to this.
Well, I was in good shape because at one point somebody from philosophy said to me, if we hadn't known you from before, we would have probably said go away because we would have figured that some medical student got the crazy idea that philosophy was an easy PhD and that they didn't really want to do the hard work of getting a PhD in a real science. So they figure, well, let me get a PhD. I can just have a title to stick on my at the end of my name, and philosophy should be a slam dunk because it can't really be any work involved in doing philosophy. But we know you from before because you were enrolled in a number of philosophy courses. I'd studied with, you know, some of the people in the department who were, you know, fairly well known, like Stephen Tolman taught a course at that time. And so they had a sense that I was serious, that I was not under false impressions about what the about the you know, what it took to actually commit oneself to graduate work in philosophy. So they were welcoming and they were open to that.
Do you know if there have been any other medical students who've done a PhD in philosophy?
I don't know of any other medical students who have done a PhD in philosophy, which is a disappointment to me. I would have hoped that we would have had a little. I never, ever would have expected a lot would have done it, but you'd think every 3-4 years one might do it because of the kind of place this is.
Okay, so then you finished your MD and your PhD at the same time?
Yeah, basically, I did the MD and actually officially graduated in 76, and then I had another year to finish the PhD, and I finished that in 77.
Okay, and then you went off to do a residency.
Right.
In Virginia?
In Virginia, University of Virginia, Charlottesville.
Okay. How did that compare with MSU?
Well, in most ways, totally different. It was, of course, a big medical center. And the, you know, so it was a university hospital. And the, in one way, it was somewhat similar because I'd worked with the people in human development so much that even though in the end I ended up doing family practice, I felt in a way the human development department was more of my home at CHM. And eventually I got to work in the family practice, but at that time it was just really a skeleton department. There was hardly anybody there. I enjoyed the people who were there, but it wasn't as developed a place as human development was then. And again, when I got to Virginia, I found that I was, of course, in the Department of Family Practice, and those were my peers and my friends. But of all the other departments, the fun people were the pediatricians. They were just generally nicer, and the internal medicine people were basically nice, but they were a much more compulsive group of people. We won't talk about sphincters here, but the people who were a little bit more relaxed and a little bit more human were the pediatricians. So it was, but again, it was the difference between a small medical school that's very community based and in, you know, feels very comfortable in a community hospital setting versus a major medical center with a big university hospital where all of the activity is pretty much focused around the university hospital and the sort of looking down their noses at what went on in the community hospital, which is of course the place I'd been trained in and felt comfortable in.
Okay. How were you regarded by the people in Virginia? As a strange duck?
I think there were two things about it. First of all, at that particular point in time, family practice was a sufficiently new kid on the block, somewhat beleaguered, somewhat number two try harder sort of specialty, that it couldn't necessarily afford to be snooty about who chose to come into family practice. So if somebody, if somebody elected to sign up for family practice residency and wanted to be in family medicine, it was like, come on, you know, yeah. not like, who are you or do we really mm-hmm. want you? The situation, what I was doing, the fact that I was doing the PhD probably eliminated me from what at the time was actually my first choice residency. I was actually admitted to my second choice residency in Charlottesville. My first choice, which in the hindsight I'm very glad I didn't go to, and I'm very glad I did go to Charlottesville, was at Hershey in the program there, because they had a medical humanities department mm-hmm. at Hershey Medical Center that time. And so I fantasized that if I went to do my residency there, I would have my family practice ties, but also I would have these humanities people and mm-hmm. bioethics people to work with a little bit. And in hindsight, that probably wasn't such a great idea. But at any rate, I heard rumors that Hershey ranked me lower, in part because they thought I was such a strange duck. They weren't, yeah. because I had the PhD and they had this interest, they just couldn't really believe that I was real.
You couldn't be serious about
I couldn't medicine. Be serious about medicine if I had this other training and this other set of interests. So they discounted that. The people at Charlottesville were willing to give me a trial and imagined that I could actually perform there as well as... Mm-hmm. You know, doing having whatever I might contribute as a result of my interests.
Yeah. Okay. Were you able to do anything with the philosophy during your residency?
I did in pretty much only one way. Obviously, I had an interest, and I continued. And it turned out at University of Virginia, even though they didn't have an actual department or a program, they had what was called the Medical Center Hour. And the Medical Center Hour was a 1 hour a week conference, but it actually had pretty good attendance. It was sort of like a center wide grand rounds, mm-hmm. and it was under the aegis of their former dean of the medical school, Tom Hunter. And Tom Hunter had developed a relationship with Joe Fletcher as one of the first theologians and scholars in ethics to become interested in medical ethics. And he had Joe Fletcher come down regularly as a visiting professor to Virginia from his home in Massachusetts. So we regularly had these medical center hours. They were once a week. And Joe Fletcher, three or four times a year, would show up and talk about medical ethics. Mm-hmm. And other people would come and talk about medical ethics. And on a couple of occasions, I ended up being on panels or somehow got involved with the medical center hour. And Tom Hunter, you know, learned about my interest and sort of took me under his wing a little bit and tried to encourage me. And Joe Fletcher was very cordial at that time mm-hmm. in trying to encourage me. Because of what we had done in human development, and we'd produced this program text, and we had tried it out with some elective courses of students, by the time I was finishing up my program at Michigan State, that actually got published as a textbook in medical ethics. And it actually is, if you go back and look, is really one of the oldest or the first yep. in this wave of medical ethics textbooks. Of course, it never got the success that it was about a year or so later that Beecham and Childress came out with their first edition of the Principles of Biomedical Ethics, yep. and that kind of dominated the market from that point on. But you know, as a so-called single authored text, it was unique at that time. So we had an edition that came out in 1976 of that, and then as I was in my residency, the Little Brown and Company expressed an interest in a second edition of that. Mm-hmm. So I actually was able to take some of my so-called research time in my last year mm-hmm. of residency and work on revising that text, so that a 1981 edition then came out mm-hmm. that at least part of it I had worked on when I was in my residency. Mm-hmm. So those were the two things that happened in my residency that I was able to actually build on or make use of my philosophy. But of course, the residency experience is so intensive that there just really isn't all that much opportunity to formally involve oneself in non-medical type things.
So then you came back to MSU when you finished your residency?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I'm not 100% sure exactly what happened. Art Corman says that basically that's his work, that I had sort of asked, I was starting to look for a job, and I frankly thought it sort of unlikely that I would come back to Michigan State at first. But of course, because I had the ties to Michigan State and I knew the people there, I said, well, you know, I am looking for a job. And according to Art, what Art told me later while Roy and Gerard in family practice had some interest in my coming back, and Andy, and at that time Don Weston was the dean, and you know Andy would have wanted to have me back to come into the medical humanities program that he was then the director of. You know, this putting together an actual position that would land me in both places was just sort of everybody was imagining someone else was going to do it. And so they were just sort of sitting around and nothing was being done. And Art says that he was the one who really sort of grabbed it and ran with it and made it happen so that there was actually a job that I could be offered here. And when things, I interviewed at about four places, and every other place could see hiring a person who was a family physician. And you would have a certain period of time, it was usually about 20% to 30% of your time, that was officially your research time. And so you would be hired as a family physician, and you would have this research time. And then in that research time, they didn't care what you did. You'd do whatever your research was. And if I was interested in iron deficiency anemia or intestinal worms or the plague or whatever, that would be what I do with my research time. And it was sort of, who cares what you do then? You just do your research. And the one place that said, well, you've got training in family practice, you've got training in philosophy, so let's put together a job that includes family practice and philosophy and ethics and give you a job that is a job to do what you were trained to do. The one place that had the kind of imagination to put that job description together was Michigan State. So that, and the fact that my wife has family here in Michigan and she sort of wanted to come back, was she was pregnant then, we just about to have our daughter, and she sort of wanted to be around her family, those were the deciding factors to come back to Michigan State at that time.
Okay. How did, after you came back, how did you intersect with human development?
When I came back, my intersections with human development were mostly people-driven. In other words, the particular individuals in human development with whom I had some kind of prior relationship as a student were people that I tried to sort of stay in touch with and sort of know about. But my home shifted over. Of course, my home became family practice and the medical humanities program, and I no longer felt that sort of my place to hang out was human development. So that piece sort of never quite replicated itself after I came back. So I've never really felt that attachment to human development since coming back. So I feel individual attachment to individual people, and of course over the years they've drifted away and other people have come. And now I have very little connection to human development and hardly know what's going on over there. But I think also there was the general growth of the medical school, that obviously there was a time when everybody knew everybody at the medical school, and now we're in a phase when you don't know a lot of people at the medical school. Nobody knows anybody. So that happened too.
For some reason, human development never got very close relationships with family practice. I've never been sure quite why that was.
And the way people in family practice think about it is that in pediatrics and in medicine, you figure that there's going to be sort of two groups of folks, and one group is going to be the people you're very close with, and the other people are sort of going to be at arm's length. And the people you expect to be very close with are the people who do the general pediatrics and the general medicine. And it appeared at the time that I came back into family practice is while there continued to be a fairly active general medicine group, and we had people like Ruth Hoppe and Bob Smith and others that we could relate to in medicine, that the number of pediatricians who identified themselves as doing any sort of general pediatrics was dwindling. And everybody in pediatrics was in some subspecialty practice. So we, I think in many ways, Department of Family Practice felt that we could not relate to peds in the way we could relate to medicine. Now, at the same time, I don't know to what extent this was actually still a factor, but when Roy Gerard came, you may remember some of that history, when Roy Gerard came to be chair of family practice, that something happened with Bill Weil and Scott Swisher where an opportunistic sort of thing developed where they put in a grant and got it funded to do a joint med-peds residency. And that was viewed by the family practice community at the time as anti-family practice. It was as if Michigan State was going on the map, and Michigan State was saying that We are anti-family practice, and family practice is not welcome here, because the model we're going to use is this: if you want to do kids and adults both, you would, of course, take a joint medicine pediatrics residency. So family practice is not getting any institutional support. And the feeling was is that once this residency got going, it would suck up any resources that otherwise might be given to family practice. So what Roy Girard was told by his people around the state, who didn't necessarily wish him well, but were more trying to make trouble, his fellow residency directors basically said, well, if you take that job at Michigan State, you're a turncoat. You're no longer a true blue family doc in the cause. You're going over to the enemy if you go to Michigan State. And so when Roy became the chair at Michigan State, several people vowed, in effect, they were going to get him because he had turned his back on his roots in family medicine by going to this hostile environment. So if you were in family medicine during those years, that didn't necessarily make pediatrics and medicine your best pals. And how Roy dealt with that, I'm not sure. But, of course, that dealt with sort of how he got along with Bill Weil and Scott Swisher. But, you know, there was that little bit of antagonism right from the get-go, and I don't know if that affected later relations or not.
I think probably did, because in peds, there was always the sense that, gee, the family practitioners only had one rotation in pediatrics. How could they treat children?
Yeah.
Okay, so you came back, and when did you form the center? The center was formed?
The center was formed, and in some ways, well, I had a little something to do with the formation of the center, because what eventually became the center, what was then called the Medical Humanities Program, was the was an idea that was developed as a result of my doing the graduate work in the medical school and in the philosophy department with the involvement of the medical school. And the fact that half my graduate committee was medical school types and half was philosophy, that created this interdisciplinary mix on my committee. And then the question sort of came up is, and then we started somewhere along the line, we started doing, again, under my assistantship that Bill Weil paid for, we were doing this, where we started doing hospital conferences on ethics case conferences at the local hospitals. So we were the first really thing going on in Lansing community that was a hospital-based effort to do some ongoing education around ethics. And then, and I was doing that as a grad student, as my student assistantship, and then the question was, well, if Howard leaves and he's done and he goes off to do his residency, then what? And so that led people to think about, well, what kind of program should we have here? And we brought in some experts nationally. At that time, there was a major, I think it was Rockefeller-funded thing, which I'm blocking on the name of right now, but it was a national thing that basically if you called them up, they would send somebody like Ed Pellegrino, who was a national big shot in the field, to come to your medical school and sort of snoop around for a couple, 3 days and give you advice on what kind of program you might have in medical ethics and humanities. Yep. And so we brought in Pellegrino and some other people from other medical centers as part of that. They had actually two visits, as I recall, and they recommended the creation of some kind of program, that Michigan State had all the resources with this medical school here on campus, and it was natural to think about doing this. And then right about that time was when Andy was being pushed out of the deanship, and so you had to have a pastor to send old Andy out to not have him, you know, make too much trouble anywhere else. And so this became then a handy pastor to put Andy in, so he became the new, which, you know, is, I'm saying that not to denigrate Andy, I'm saying that to denigrate the people who thought of Andy in that light, that the new wave of the department chairs who were thought they were smarter than he was. But that, you know, did give the wherewithal to create this this program, and it was kind of whatever guilt funds then for people who felt badly about having booted Andy out of the deanship, where we could sort of milk that to get some resources into the medical humanities program. So that created the program. At basically at the same time that I left then to go to do my residency, the medical humanities program was created. So then when they hired me to come back, I was Andy's assistant in the medical humanities program. And we had at that time half-time appointments, so either Bruce Miller or Martin Benjamin could come over from philosophy and work part-time in the keeping it going. And then we got the grant from National Endowment for the Humanities for curriculum development, which allowed us to hire in Tom Tomlinson, who had helped Andy write the grant, I believe, as a grad assistant. And then we gradually grew the group through the early years of the 1980s with through that, mostly through that grant, big grant from National Endowment for the Humanities. So then I became the director when Andy, I was acting director for 1 year because Andy went off on sabbatical and back to Stanford again, I think, for a year.
Yep, he studied adolescent medicine.
Yeah, right. And I and I was acting director for that year. So then when Andy finally did retire and went down to Georgia in 1985, I became the new director of the Medical Humanities Program. And in 1988, we succeeded in getting the provost to rename it the Center for Ethics and Humanities in the Life Sciences, which we didn't want that long a name, but the provost insisted that that's what we had to tack on in the Life Sciences. And so that's when the program became the center. Right. It was during my watch when I was director for the 15 years. But it was already a going concern when I arrived. And the main growth thing, the spur for the growth in those early years was that big grant, which I had nothing to do with. That right. was already a done deal by the time I arrived. So mm-hmm. I can't take any credit for that.
Okay. And you worked a little with Andy.
Mm-hmm.
You worked with Don Weston.
Never what? Directly Not worked right. with Don Weston. Okay. He was dean during those years that I was here, and he was those early years that I was here, and was very supportive of what I was doing. I've felt I had excellent support yeah. from all the deans. I've never had a dean at Human Medicine who didn't seem to value what I was doing in the college.
Okay, I was going to ask. I'm blocking on his name. The guy who followed Don.
Bill Abbott.
Yeah. Who. Our impression was never very supportive of our department.
Yeah, he always seemed, as near as we could tell, to be supportive of the Center for Ethics and Humanities, so we never felt badly supported under Bill either. Mm-hmm. Again, we were just pretty fortunate. And, of course, the Center for Ethics and Humanities is a relatively low-budget item, so yep. you don't have to shell off much hard cash in order to be supportive of it. So it makes it a somewhat mm-hmm. nice sort of thing. And then there was a period of time there when the Center for Ethics reported to when we had a so-called vice provost for health programs.
Oh, yes.
And there was about a 3-year period when officially I reported as director to Harvey Sparks as vice provost rather than to the dean of human medicine. So, and that was also, that was a good relationship too because Harvey liked what we were doing and he mm-hmm. was very supportive and tried to help us out in a variety of ways.
Okay. And now you're heading toward Galveston?
Yes.
Too bad.
Thank you. And I see at Galveston a really interesting opportunity in the sense that, unlike most places in bioethics in the U.S., most places started with a strong bioethics core, and relatively few put resources into humanities.
Right.
And so many of the more bioethics-oriented programs are now somewhat belatedly trying to become bioethics and humanities programs, mm-hmm. of which I'd say we're one here. And so they're trying to bring in more people in non-bioethics disciplines, and like, you know, literature and history and, yeah. and religion and so on. And then they're struggling with sort of a bit of culture shock because, unfortunately, many of the people in bioethics are relatively narrow, and you'd think they'd be naturally sort of interdisciplinary people, but they're not necessarily. And so they don't always take kindly to rubbing shoulders with these new folks. And Galveston has gone exactly the opposite direction. They have some very good people there doing bioethics, but bioethics has always been something of a byproduct of the larger endeavor in medical humanities, mm-hmm. which actually started out with history. And then grew in literature and religious studies and other areas. And now they're looking to really, I see they have an opportunity now to really build their bioethics, but on an truly interdisciplinary base. And the other thing they haven't done there is they really haven't brought in social science. The mm-hmm. social science activity at Galveston has been pretty minimal for one thing, and it's been outside the Medical yep. Humanities Institute. So it seemed like a really impressive opportunity to do some things in a part of the world that is fascinating because of its multiculturalism and mm-hmm. its commitment, historical commitment to the care of the underserved, in on a really, really, really strong programmatic base and with some resources promised by their dean to grow mm-hmm. the program there and bring in. I said that the first thing I want to do is hire a bioethicist with an interest in health policy.
Right.
And next thing I want to do is hire a bioethicist who's also into anthropology. And she said, yes, go get those people, hire them, bring mm-hmm. them in. And then we also said we really should have some clinical bioethicists who are part-time in the institute and part-time in clinical departments. She said, yep, go get those people. Let's bring them in. So it seems like a unique opportunity in this day and age to try to grow something.
And you couldn't do here.
And sadly, growth is not, you know, we need to grow here, but we need to grow in something that'll bring in a little bit of cash, and bioethics and humanities ain't it. So it does seem like a time when what I want to do is not as quite as flourishing here at Michigan State as what it is elsewhere.
Good. Okay. Summarize your experience here.
Well, the, boy, how do I even begin to do that? Again, there's probably a lot of ways I don't quite understand now and really appreciate now where it was in some ways mere by chance that I just dropped into this thing, which was called human development. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to say that my career would have been different, how my career would have been different had I landed. What if you hadn't had a job?
Yep.
And what if I'd gone some other place? Mm-hmm. And what if I ended up washing test tubes in some lab in physiology, let's say? Maybe I would have gotten interested in these things. Maybe I wouldn't have gotten interested in these things. But I really, looking back, have to imagine that the good luck I had to drop into human development, you know, to be in contact with CHM when I was in contact with CHM during those, if you will, sort of the tail end of the glory years when really exciting new stuff was happening and when the faculty were so excited about everything that was happening, and that excitement was, you know, influencing the student mentality and the way everybody functioned here. But of within CHM, then to have the special kind of home that I had in human development, and very early on, I can't remember just how this happened. It was a combination of the job and the graduate assistantships and so on and the kind of people, but it always seemed like that was the place to go. If I just wanted to hang out somewhere, the place to go naturally was to human development. And I have to imagine that the kind of interdisciplinary sense of the place and mission of the place had to have had a real strong impact on me. And the fact, you know, it's not merely the fact that I went off into bioethics in addition to my interest in medicine, but how have I done bioethics? Well, I've tried to do bioethics in a way that brought in narrative and in a way that thought about issues of power, which is something that maybe social scientists do more with than philosophers do. And the fact that then I ran off and got interested in history and did a project in history of medicine, it just seems as if my my nature is to be interdisciplinary about whatever it is I do and try to find the piece of it that somebody hasn't explored yet. And the reason they haven't explored it is because it bridges into another discipline that people didn't want to go into. And by saying, let's look at that discipline, I can see some new bit of light that maybe wasn't shined on that field previously. And this sense this, I have to imagine that my early years of contact with human development had to have nurtured that piece of me. And there was some of that was present as an undergrad and even before I ended up in the medical school. But and I did, you know, in high school have some teachers who were the models of the old-fashioned idea of a liberal education, and especially a Latin teacher I had who taught Western civilization and called it Latin. So I had some good teachers all along, and maybe I would have still somehow stumbled into some of what I've done, but it certainly must have been a great advantage to me to have had this early contact with the people in human development and the kind of place that it was in those years.
But those were the days, I think, when we had an expanding budget curve, and anything seemed possible, and we had no structure that we had to overcome.
Yeah. And when I think about people like, you know, I knew Mike Bailey, I knew Tom Helmrath, and obviously their areas of research were quite different from what I was interested in. And I remember going by Tom Helmrath's lab and he'd be cutting up some baby pig or something, and this poor little pig was it's terrible. But, you know, he was interested in neonatology and, and the, you know, neonatal physiology, and he was doing his stuff, and Mike Bailey was doing his physiology work. And never, ever had a sense that there was any condescension or any superiority, that what they were doing was better than what Doris Nerens was doing or what you were doing. There was all, we were all doing our thing, and everybody was doing their own discipline, and wasn't it great we were all in the same department. So it really was an environment that it's probably, if you had never have seen it, you would have been surprised to hear about it. And given that I sort of landed in it without knowing any better, I just sort of took it for granted that that's the way the world ought to be.
Okay. Thank you kindly.
You're very welcome.